Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, they called for a ceasefire. ASU called the cops. The story was written by TJ LeHeru and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on May 3rd. When faced with a peaceful protest, the cops made mass arrests. If they can, they'll justify it later. Across the country, colleges and universities are facing a consequential test. As pro-Palestinian protests have roiled campus after campus, school administrators have called in the cops to crack down on student expression. While some protests have been less peaceful than others, students protesting what they've called Israel's genocidal offensive in Gaza have occupied and vandalized university buildings at both Columbia and UCLA, there's a common thread between them: an overwhelming response from the police. Though tensions haven't run as high in Arizona, the state's three public universities have been just as happy to sic police on their own students. At the University of Arizona in Tucson, police arrested about 70 protesters conducting a sit-in on campus, deploying physical force and chemical irritants on the orders of the school's president, Robert Robbins. At Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, police arrested 24 people Tuesday, including 22 students. In an Instagram post, protesters could be heard chanting, "There's no riot here. Why are you in riot gear?" as police moved in. The largest number of arrests, however, were made at Arizona State University in Tempe. On April 26th, protesters led by a group called Students Against Apartheid set up an encampment in the evening on the lawn outside Old Main. By the next morning, campus police in riot gear, aided by troopers from the Arizona Department of Public Safety and deputies from the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, had arrested 72 of the protesters. The officers were less than tactful. An ABC 15 camera caught ASU Police Chief Michael Thompson out of uniform and brandishing a knife as he destroyed protesters' tents. The media outlet also obtained a video of police forcibly removing the hijabs of several Muslim women who begged for humanity, their attorney told the Arizona Republic, in an apparent violation of civil rights reminiscent of one that recently cost New York City $17.5 million. And though it's been nearly a week since the arrests, not a single arrested protester has been charged with a crime. Three protesters arrested April 26th were released after University Lakes Justice Court Judge William Coffin ruled that they were detained without probable cause, according to court documents. The other 69 have been accused of trespassing, but are currently stuck in legal limbo. The charge is a Class 3 misdemeanor that typically does not result in jailing, though nearly all protesters arrested early Saturday were held in custody until later that evening. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office makes charging decisions, but County Attorney Rachel Mitchell said Thursday that she hadn't received the necessary documents from police to determine if protesters will be charged. While the legal system may grind slowly, ASU apparently doesn't. The university quickly excised arrested students from campus life, suspending them and barring them from finishing classes, communicating with professors, and entering their own dorm rooms. On Tuesday, lawyers for 20 of the students, including one who was immediately released due to a lack of probable cause, filed a First Amendment lawsuit in federal court against the Arizona Board of Regents, as well as a motion for a preliminary injunction to reverse what it called enforced homelessness and automatic class failure. David Chami, One of the lawyers for the students told Phoenix New Times that by arresting and punishing the students, ASU was attempting to crush their spirit and to strip them of their constitutional rights to free speech and to assemble. I think it's abhorrent, and it's against everything we're supposed to stand for as Americans, Chami added. Disproportionate response. Chami was hardly alone in expressing alarm. At a gathering Thursday in Tempe, Michael Kincher of United Campus Workers was among several students, alumni, and faculty who spoke out against the university's heavy-handed approach to policing speech. The use of violence and institutional discipline to disrupt a peaceful student demonstration violates students' constitutionally protected right to free speech and assembly on public property, Kincher said. The forced removal of hijabs, apparently committed by ASU police, although the agency has not responded to many outlets asking it to confirm its involvement, trampled the First Amendment in another way, said Aza Abusif, the executive director of the Muslim Civil Rights Advocacy Organization, Council on American-Islamic Relations. The First Amendment guarantees the free practice of religion. Police cannot suspend that right, Abusif said. We condemn the reported actions of ASU police and call for a full investigation into this incident. In a statement, the university said encampments are against school policy and claimed that only 15 of those arrested were ASU students. But protesters said that claim is false and was made several hours before police checked arrestees' academic status. 20 students are party to the lawsuit filed against the Board of Regents, and a group protesting the school's response Thursday claimed that 27 students, along with several staff and alumni, were arrested. The 20 students suing the Board of Regents and perhaps other students who were arrested are now facing consequences from the university despite not having been charged with a crime. Suspended students may appeal their punishment, but must submit that request to the Office of Student Rights and Responsibilities before midnight on Saturday. The legal system may get there first. A hearing on the student's motion for a preliminary injunction is set for Friday afternoon at the Sandra Day O'Connor U.S. Courthouse. Speaking to reporters at the gathering Thursday, ASU alumnus Tartil Al-Imam decried the school's disproportionate response. To punish these students to threaten their academic careers and jeopardize their futures would not only be unjust, but would also send a chilling message that dissent and activism are not welcome or tolerated within our academic institutions, Al-Imam said. At other campus protests, police have adopted a similar arrest first, justify it later approach to quelling free speech. At a University of Texas protest, a judge dismissed charges against 57 arrested protesters because, as the Austin American Statesman reported, police copied and pasted each probable cause affidavit for every person arrested. Such shortcuts don't fly, Mitchell told reporters Thursday. You can't lump people together, Mitchell said. You have to show that a particular individual committed particular acts that constitute a crime. In deciding whether to charge ASU's protesters, Mitchell said there will be immediate higher-up involvement in reviewing the case for charges once ASU police file arrest paperwork. On that score, though, the county attorney's office doesn't have the best track record. In 2021, under Mitchell's predecessor, charges against anti-police brutality protesters were fabricated by prosecutors and the Phoenix Police Department, who colluded to convince a grand jury the protesters were a gang that was as dangerous as the Bloods. The case fell apart. Why they're protesting? What drew protesters to Old Main and to conduct campus sit-ins across the country was the carnage of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. Launched in response to Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack that killed 1,200 Israelis and abducted at least 200 more, the war has raged for nearly 7 months and resulted in the deaths of more than 34,000 Gazan civilians, two-thirds of whom have been women and children. Despite that, the U.S. government has continued to supply Israel with military aid. So, unable to sway their elected officials, campus protesters are trying to exert what influence they have over their academic institutions. Aside from general calls for a ceasefire, protesters at ASU and elsewhere have called for their universities to sever financial ties that might provide aid to Israel, including divesting from companies and funds that generate profits directly or indirectly as a result of the Israeli Defense Forces campaign. ASU, for instance, has an endowment fund of more than $1.5 billion that it invests in stocks, bonds, and other financial securities. Protesters are demanding that money isn't used to invest in the perpetration of mass killing. ASU is destroying our investments in our education for exercising our constitutional rights to speak up against genocide, the students arrested wrote in a statement. They called on ASU to divest from all its financial ties to the State of Israel, as well as companies supplying the Israeli military for its brutal actions towards the people of Gaza. The BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, dates back to 2005, although it has yet to generate much traction. 38 states, including Arizona, have since passed laws prohibiting state governments from investing in companies that support BDS, or from doing business with contractors that support a boycott of Israel. But in the wake of recent protests, at least some colleges have signaled a willingness to discuss the subject of divestment. ASU apparently is not. They called the cops instead. It is reprehensible that instead of choosing to come to the table to discuss their community's concerns, ASU's administration decided to respond with unnecessary and overwhelming force, the arrested students said. Stephen Lemons contributed to this report. Arizona's 1864 abortion ban, repealed by state senate. This next story was written by Gloria Rebecca Gomez of the Arizona Mirror and was posted on the New Times website on May 3rd. Update: Governor Katie Hobbs signed the repeal into law on May 2nd, although it's still unclear when it will take effect. The Arizona Senate on Wednesday finalized repealing a near-total abortion ban that the state Supreme Court ruled in early April trumps a 15-week restriction that was implemented in 2022. But that doesn't mean the 1864 abortion ban won't go into effect, or that it will be repealed quickly, even though legislation to do so has now been passed by both legislative chambers. While the Senate approved House Bill 2677 on a 16-14 vote, with Republican Senators Shauna Bullock and T.J. Shope joining all of the chamber's Democrats in support, a ministerial delay will stop the bill from being sent to Governor Katie Hobbs for weeks. That's because the House ended its work for the day before the Senate could vote on the bill, so the lower chamber hasn't formally received the bill in order to transmit it to the governor. And that won't happen until May 15th, the next day the House is set to be in session. After falling short for weeks, the House voted to repeal the 1864 law on April 24th. Hobbs, who has called on legislators to repeal the Civil War-era ban, has said that she will swiftly sign legislation to do so. But even when she does, the ban won't end. Instead, that will happen only 90 days after the legislature ends its annual session. And with little progress made on the state budget, It's unclear when the session will end, and that 90-day clock will start ticking. In the meantime, Attorney General Chris Mays is asking the state Supreme Court to pause its ruling implementing the 1864 law so her office can craft an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court on the grounds that the state justices improperly are injecting themselves into a different federal case about an Arizona abortion law. Bullock, who is a staunch anti-abortion advocate, defended her vote by explaining her history with a miscarriage. Her unviable pregnancy was ended with the DNC, the surgical procedure used in about half of abortions in Arizona, and later successful pregnancies. Many women don't have textbook pregnancies, she said, explaining that she is unsure if her DNC procedure would have been allowed under the 1864 ban because it was needed for her health, even though her life was not yet in immediate danger. Republicans incensed over repeal. Other Republicans were incensed. Senator Jake Hoffman, who heads up the far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus, said the near-total abortion ban is one of the best, strongest, pro-life measures in the country. He said it was representative of and reflective of our founding fathers' intent. That two Republicans crossed party lines to end that ban, Hoffman said, is unconscionable. It is disgusting that this is the state of the Republican Party today, he said. Senator Anthony Kern, Republican Glendale, said it was insanity. The Bullock and Shope claimed to be pro-life, but still supported allowing abortions in Arizona. The craziest thing I've seen and heard is, I'm pro-life, yet I'm going to vote to repeal the abortion ban. It's insanity to me, he said. Adding abortion is part of a plot to destroy this country. David Gowan, a Republican from Sierra Vista, compared Wednesday's vote to the September 11th terrorist attacks. Today feels like 9/11, he said. At stake was literally life and death for Arizonans, said Senator David Farnsworth, Republican Mesa. Have we become so evil, he said? God is watching. Here's a story by Caitlin Sievers of the Arizona Mirror, posted on the New Times website on May 3rd. Carrie Lake's lawyer apparently doesn't know how appeals work. Appellate judges listening to arguments Thursday in Carrie Lake's challenge to her 2022 election loss had to keep reminding her lawyer how appeals courts work. I'm sure you're aware we're not a fact-finding court. We're a court that decides questions of law, primarily, Judge Peter Eckerstrom told Kurt Olson, Lake's attorney, shortly after he began his arguments. Lake, a Republican who is now running for a U.S. Senate seat, filed her initial election challenge in December 2022 after she lost the governor's race to Democrat Katie Hobbs by more than 17,000 votes. An ally of fellow election denier Donald Trump, Lake never conceded to Hobbs and has continually claimed the election was stolen, despite her claims failing to convince judges in December 2022 and May 2023 trials, as well as multiple appeals in between the two. Olson on Thursday focused on claims that Maricopa County didn't conduct required logic and accuracy testing for its tabulators and ballot-on-demand printers ahead of the 2022 election, leading to issues with those tabulators reading ballots on Election Day. Maricopa County has continually denied Lake's allegations that it failed to perform logic and accuracy tests required by law. More than once during the proceedings, which lasted less than an hour, the judges had to remind Olson, a Washington, D.C. employment attorney, that the function of the appeals court is to determine if the trial judge made mistakes in interpreting and applying the law, not in determining the facts of the case. Olson argued that he and Lake's other attorney in the case, Scottsdale divorce lawyer Brian Blem, did not have access to tabulator records in time to properly analyze them before the trial. He also claimed that Maricopa County Elections Director Scott Jarrett lied on the stand during the December trial about logic and accuracy testing, and the reason tabulators at some polling locations kept rejecting ballots on November 8, 2022. He also accused trial court Judge Peter Thompson of disregarding the testimony of Lake's cybersecurity expert, Claim Parikh, about the tabulators and printers. But when one of the judges asked Olson how he knew that Judge Thompson had disregarded the evidence, Olson didn't have an answer. Hogwash. He also continued to claim that tens of thousands of voters either got out of line or never went to the polls on Election Day 2022 because of the tabulator problems. Tom Liddy, an attorney from Maricopa County, described that allegation as hogwash, an assessment seemingly in line with the trial judge's take. During the trial, Thompson dismissed Richard Barris, a Lake witness called to back up the claim. Barris made those claims based not on direct evidence, but on a poll he conducted. No election in Arizona has ever been set aside, no result modified, because of a statistical estimate, Thompson wrote about Barris's testimony in his December 24, 2022 opinion. Election contests are decided by votes, not by polling responses, and the court has found no authority suggesting that exit polling ought to be used in this manner. Additionally, Olson claimed on Thursday that at least 6,700 ballots were not counted on Election Day 2022, something that the county denies and has never been proven. But Judge Sean Brercliff pointed out that even if it were true, it wouldn't have made a difference in the governor's race. Let me make one thing absolutely clear to every single person in the state of Arizona, Liddy told the court. Not a single ballot was rejected. Every single lawful ballot cast was tabulated. But Olson argued that the results of Lake's trials should be set aside based on new evidence that wasn't available during the trials, including the tabulator logs. However, he admitted that he had access to those before the mail trial, but didn't have time to analyze them. When Judge Earl Epic asked Olson what remedy he was looking for, Olson answered, "The remedy is to set aside the election." In summing up his argument, Olson alleged that two-thirds of Maricopa County's voting centers, quote, completely failed on Election Day 2022. Around 70% of vote centers experienced issues with their tabulators that day, but Lake never claimed that all those centers shut down or that they didn't accept any ballots. "If you don't follow the law, people will not trust elections," Olson told the court. That's where it's coming to in this country. At the end of the hearing, Eckerstrom attempted one final time to push Olson to make arguments that are appropriate for the appeals court. "We are a court of law, and we don't decide facts in the first instance, and the thrust of what you've been arguing in your summation is facts and fact findings," Eckerstrom told Olson. "Could you identify what the trial court did wrong as a matter of law? What's your primary argument that the trial court did as a matter of law?" Olson answered that the trial court judge improperly set the bar too high in requiring that Lake prove election fraud, instead of a lower bar of unintentional error or suspicion that the results couldn't be trusted. He added that the purportedly new evidence regarding the tabulators showed the county officials tried to downplay ballot printer and tabulator issues on Election Day. Brercliff told the court that the judges would rule on the appeal in due course, but did not provide any further clarification of when that might be. This next story was written by T.J. LeHaru and was posted on May 1st. Carrie Lake trumpets endorsement from alleged wife beater Sonny Borelli. U.S. Senate candidate Carrie Lake on Sunday announced she was endorsed by State Senator Sonny Borelli, a Republican with a history of domestic violence and misogyny. In addition to Borelli's domestic violence incidents years ago, in March, the Lake Havasu City Republican also notoriously suggested that women should put aspirin between their knees as a means of birth control. Borelli, the Senate Majority Leader, is the second most powerful lawmaker in the chamber. "It's an honor to be in this fight with you," Lake said in a social media post about Borelli's support. "Arizona is lucky to have you." The backing from Borelli is just another feather in Lake's endorsement cap, which also includes support from Senator Jake Hoffman. The powerful Republican is among Arizona's 11 fake electors recently indicted and facing 9 felony charges for their alleged efforts in trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Lake has also hugged it up with a prominent young white nationalist, but Wade Searle hasn't formally endorsed her Senate run. In the early 2000s, police responded to 2 domestic violence incidents involving Borelli and his second wife, Julie. In March 2001, Borelli was arrested after he punched Julie, quote, in the mouth 3 times and pushed her to the ground during an argument, according to police records. An officer observed Julie had dried blood around her mouth. Julie's 14-year-old son, David W. Natterchall Jr., Borelli's stepson, said Borelli pushed Julie into a video poker machine in the living room, after which she could not stand up and crawled across the floor. 15 years later, Natterchall wrote a letter retracting his statement to police, saying he was coached by his mother. According to police, Julie yelled for Natterchall to call 911. He told police when Borelli found out that he was on the phone, the future politician broke down a locked door and ripped the phone from the wall. Borelli then told Natterchall to wake his brother and pack his clothes because, quote, they were going to leave. Borelli pleaded guilty to a Class 1 misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge tagged with domestic violence, which was reduced from the initial assault charge he received from the Lake Havasu City Police Department. He told Arizona Capital Times in 2016 that he pleaded guilty to quickly settle the case and avoid losing custody of his son from his first marriage, who was not involved in the incident. Lake's campaign did not respond to a request for comment on Borelli's endorsement. Put it between your knees. 3 years later, police were called again. In August 2004, Borelli called 911, claiming Julie had come at him with a knife raised above her head. An officer who interviewed Borelli reported, he thinks he struck his wife in the face while attempting to get the knife away. Borelli had several 6-inch-long scratches on his chest that appeared to have barely broken the skin, the officer noted. Another officer went to a local hospital where Julie received treatment. The subsequent police report stated that she, quote, had a large amount of dried blood completely covering the lower portion of her face, as well as dried / smeared blood on her hands and arms, and noticeable bruise / swelling on the right side of her neck, near her lower jaw. The officer also noted a bloody tooth chip was sitting on a bedside tray. Prosecutors never pursued a case, and the statute of limitations expired. In November 2013, Borelli and Julie began divorce proceedings. In 2016, Borelli called his then ex-wife a lying bitch in an interview with Phoenix New Times. That same year, Arizona Capital Times reported that Julie was serving a year-long sentence for attempted theft. Borelli's tenure in government has been no less controversial. In 2017, Borelli introduced Senate Bill 1142, which equated protesting with organized crime and targeted the rights of free speech and assembly enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. In 2021, he went to Las Vegas for a QAnon conference as followers of the conspiracy theory worked with Arizona senators and audit officials in an attempt to overturn the 2020 election. In March 2024, Borelli grabbed headlines again when he spoke out and voted against a Democratic effort to guarantee a right to birth control. Like I said, Bayer Company invented aspirin. Put it between your knees, Borelli said, suggesting birth control would not be needed if women did not have sex. He claimed Democrats were, quote, creating a controversy that doesn't exist because nobody's opposing, even though he opposed the effort. The motion was blocked by Republicans in a party line vote. Next, a story written by Matt Henney and posted on April 30th. Arizona House Speaker condemns LGBTQ plus lawmaker for, quote, perverse ideology. House Speaker Ben Thoma, who last week retaliated against two gay lawmakers for their efforts to repeal the state's abortion ban, took aim at another LGBTQ plus lawmaker Tuesday for hosting a drag story hour in a state capitol conference room. Thoma banned House Democrats from using conference rooms in the House and unleashed a torrent of anti-LGBTQ plus venom at Representative Lorena Austin. The Mesa Democrat, the state's first non-binary and gender non-conforming legislator, hosted the event with Planned Parenthood on Tuesday. Use of House facilities for radical activism to promote dangerously perverse ideology will not be tolerated while I am Speaker, Thoma said in a social media post. Thoma also accused Austin of misleading House leadership about the event, which was attended by about 20 people. Bagels and a sparkly outfit. Austin and House Democrats fired back at Thoma. This is the people's house, and that includes the LGBTQ plus community, whether my colleagues on the other side of the aisle like that or not, Austin said in a prepared statement. It is nothing short of ridiculous that I have been described as dishonest, deceitful, and perverse, and have been subjected to calls for punishment and expulsion. Austin described the event as educational and part of the mission of the Arizona LGBTQ plus Legislative Caucus. What is true is that I hosted a drag performer who read stories about LGBTQ plus history and inclusion. There were no minors present, but also no content that would offend a minor. We were completely transparent when we reserved the room, and the content was not or should not be controversial, Austin said. I will never apologize for teaching people to be inclusive, to accept others as they are, and to stand up to hate and bigotry, Austin added. House Democratic Whip Nancy Gutierrez called Thoma's ban knee-jerk retaliation. No one was misled about scheduling this event, Gutierrez said in a press release. It was described as a drag story hour when Representative Austin's assistant called to reserve the room. I was there. We ate bagels and listened to a person wearing makeup and a sparkly outfit read a book and some poems about inclusion, acceptance, and LGBTQ history. It wasn't perverse. It was lovely, funny, and inspiring. Double standard discipline. Thoma, presiding over a bitterly divided chamber, retaliated against two LGBTQ plus lawmakers, Republican Representative Matt Gress and Democrat Representative Oscar de los Santos, on April 24th. The two lawmakers helped push for a repeal of the state's 160-year-old abortion ban, reinstated by the Arizona Supreme Court on April 9th. After the House approved the repeal, 32-28, De Los Santos and Gress were removed from the House Appropriations Committee. De Los Santos was also removed from the Rules Committee. Thoma's explanation for the move? "Because I've decided so," he told reporters. Later that day, a trio of House Republicans filed ethics complaints against De Los Santos and Representative Annalise Ortiz, a Phoenix Democrat. The two lawmakers sharply criticized Republicans ahead of the repeal vote on April 24th. The ethics complaint accuses the two lawmakers of orchestrating a, quote, insurrection on the House floor. The ethics complaint came a day after two Republicans, Senators Jake Hoffman and Anthony Kern, were among 11 fake electors indicted for their alleged efforts in trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Neither Hoffman nor Kern have faced any discipline in the Senate in the wake of the indictments. Kern was the first lawmaker to call out the drag story hour on social media, according to the Arizona Mirror. On April 8th, Kern led a prayer group, speaking in tongues on the Senate floor, also without consequences. Thoma is among a roster of right-wing Republicans running for Arizona's 8th congressional district seat. He's polling fourth in the GOP primary, behind Blake Masters, Abe Hamada, and Trent Franks. Kern is fifth in the race. Masters flopped in the U.S. Senate race against Senator Mark Kelly in 2022, while Hamada, the failed Arizona Attorney General candidate, picked up the endorsement of former President Donald Trump. Frank once represented the seat, but resigned in 2017 after he allegedly asked two female staffers to serve as his surrogate mothers. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on April 29th. Third woman sues Phoenix doctor for botched plastic surgery. A third woman has sued plastic surgeon Bradley Becker, accusing him of medical negligence and failing to perform the breast lift, liposuction, and revision to a tummy tuck scar that she had paid him to do. Julie Colton and her husband Jay sued Becker in Maricopa County Superior Court on January 26th. Their suit came about 4 months after Wendy Ellsworth and Alicia Armijo sued Becker, accusing him of performing drunken, botched plastic surgeries. At least five women have filed complaints against Becker to the medical board that licenses him. According to Colton's lawsuit, Becker breached his duty by failing to provide the degree of care, skill, and learning expected of a reasonable, prudent healthcare provider. Colton paid Becker $13,400 for the breast lift, lipo, and revision of a tummy tuck scar from a prior surgery, according to the lawsuit. After the surgery, Colton observed that Dr. Becker had not performed a breast lift, although he had previously agreed to do so, and plaintiff had paid him to do so, the lawsuit stated. The other two procedures that Dr. Becker had agreed to do, the scar revision and lipo procedure, were either not done or were done in such a way as to give the appearance that they were not done. The lawsuit claimed that as a result of Becker's work, Colton has been left significantly disfigured and in need of corrective cosmetic surgery, while she has experienced pain and suffering, financial difficulties, anxiety, depression, and personal embarrassment. The lawsuit is seeking past and future medical expenses related to the surgery, damages for past and future pain and suffering, and attorney's fees and expenses. "It feels like I just threw almost $15,000 in the trash," Colton told Phoenix New Times. I hate the way I look in clothes. It's depressing, and it sucks. I'm jaded. I don't have the money to go get it fixed again. The suit also claimed that as a result of the surgery, Colton and her husband experienced a loss of consortium in their marriage. Colton said that she learned of Becker through a friend who was pleased with the surgeon's work. After her own negative experience, she said she thought it would be pointless to try to speak up until reading coverage of the lawsuits from Ellsworth and Armijo. New Times was the first to report the allegations against Becker. How does he do such a good job sometimes and such a shitty job sometimes? Colton asked. Especially after hearing some of the allegations against him, it doesn't make sense. Richard Kent, Becker's attorney, said he will continue to defend Becker until the case is dismissed or won in trial. The first two lawsuits against Bradley Becker. Ellsworth and Armijo sued Becker last fall for medical negligence, battery, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Both women alleged Becker smelled strongly of alcohol before botching their surgeries. Ellsworth told New Times the surgery completely altered her personal and social life. It's hard to feel like you can go out when you feel like you're Frankenstein, Ellsworth said. I didn't go to family parties. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to dress up. If I went anywhere, I would wear really tight undergarments, trying to tuck all the extra skin they didn't take. The whole point of a tummy tuck is to not have that. In his November 17th response to the lawsuit, Becker said he complied with the standard of care and that he was not impaired during the surgery. After filing their lawsuits, Ellsworth and Armijo, along with their attorney, Robert Gregory, said they were on the receiving end of threats, stalking, and intimidation that left them concerned about the safety of their families, according to court documents filed on February 15th. In the court filing, both women said they were preparing to seek a restraining order against Becker. But Gregory told New Times that since filing those documents, neither he nor the women have experienced additional threats, so they have not pursued the restraining orders. Becker denied involvement in the latest allegations in an affidavit filed on February 21st. In a motion for Armijo's case, Gregory wrote that Armijo doesn't want to continue her case while, quote, pursuing her options with the Maricopa Sheriff's Office. Armijo's case was dismissed without prejudice on March 27th, which means she can refile the lawsuit in the future. The fact is, he has no case against my client, Kent said. In Ellsworth's case, oral arguments about a motion to dismiss the suit are scheduled for June 3rd. Five women filed complaints with medical board. In addition to the lawsuits, at least five women have filed complaints against Becker to the Arizona Board of Osteopathic Examiners in Medicine and Surgery, the board that licenses plastic surgeons. In addition, Ellsworth Armijo and Colton, Aaron Wing, and Michelle Ortiz submitted complaints to the board. The board does not send copies of complaints to people who file them and did not respond to a request for comment from New Times. But New Times reviewed emails confirming that the board received the complaints. The women who filed complaints spoke to New Times about their experiences, resulting health complications after their surgeries, dissatisfaction with their results, and lasting emotional damage. Three women said that before their surgeries, Becker acted rushed, strange, like a different person than the upbeat man who spoke with them during consultations. Four of the women said that their medical records, written by Becker's office, contained inaccurate information. At least four of the women said they did not know until well after their surgeries that Becker's office manager, Ayawana Barragao, was also his girlfriend, a fact confirmed in court documents. Several also noted in their board complaints they believed Barragao was a nurse because she provided medical advice and care to the women. All this time, I thought I was talking to a nurse, and I wasn't, Ellsworth said in October of 2023. When Ellsworth questioned the quality of the operation, she said Barragao became agitated and rude and made angry phone calls to Ellsworth, followed by friendly, encouraging texts. In interviews with New Times, three other women described receiving similar communications from Barragao. It is unclear whether Barragao is licensed to provide care. She declined to answer New Times questions about her training and licensing. Becker's court response to the Ellsworth lawsuit said that Barragao is a, quote, trained health care provider. On February 15th, Governor Katie Hobbs sent a letter to the Osteopathic Board and all of Arizona's 22 health care licensing boards expressing grave concern with a lack of transparency and accountability for health care providers in Arizona. Reporting by the Arizona Republic and Phoenix New Times has called my attention to the significant risk to protect health and safety that result from insufficient public insight into licensing board decision-making processes and outcomes, Hobbs wrote in the letter. Hobbs ordered the boards to develop standardized processes for disciplinary action and law enforcement engagement and submit them to her office by July 1st. Wait a minute. This is Banner. Surgeries of all five women who spoke to New Times were performed at Banner Surgery Center, Estrella, in Phoenix. Ellsworth said she was convinced the surgery would be fine since it took place at a facility of Banner Health, the largest employer in Arizona. I just kept going, wait a minute, this is Banner. There's no way Banner would let an inebriated doctor operate on people, Ellsworth said. Banner Health referred New Times questions about the three lawsuits and five board complaints to Atlas Healthcare Partners, which runs the surgery center and was formed as a joint venture partnership with Banner in 2018. Atlas Healthcare said it's aware of the allegations against Becker, according to Dylan McEachran, the vice president of communications for the company. We are aware of the allegations brought in the lawsuit against Dr. Becker, as he is currently a credentialed provider at Banner Surgery Center Estrella, McEachran said in an email. We monitor the state medical board daily for any actions made regarding all providers credentialed at any of our managed ambulatory surgery centers, and Banner Surgery Center Estrella follows all surgery center policies and med staff bylaws as they relate to allegations made against any credentialed provider. McEachran said Atlas had no comment on Barragao since the company does not employ her. How Tempe was part of Rolling Stones history in 1981. This next story was written by Serene Dominic and posted on May 3rd. There was enough invective about the Rolling Stones' age during their 1981 American tour that you'd mistake it for being scribbled down last week. In his review of the opening show of the tour at John F. Kennedy Stadium in Philadelphia, Kurt Loder wrote in Rolling Stone that the audience, quote, couldn't have cared less that the band was out of shape and two or three times older than many of those in the audience. The world's greatest rock and roll band had been at it for nearly 20 years. They reinvented themselves without self-destructing or sliding into irrelevancy. Let's Spend the Night Together, the 1983 concert film directed by Hal Ashby, marked this transitional period in the band's timeline. Tempe was part of it. Over half the movie is from the December 13, 1981 show at Sun Devil Stadium. With the Rolling Stones returning to Phoenix on Tuesday, it's a great time to look back at that iconic show. People remember all sorts of crazy things 4 decades later. Here is an approximation of what happened before and after the show to start you up. Editor's note, some quotes have been condensed and edited for brevity and clarity. This article originally appeared in 2019. Please let me go. There was so much excitement whipped up by the Stones that even underage fans wanted to go. In one case, a mom and her twin sons camped outside all night, outside of Rolling Stone Records, at Tower Plaza, to get tickets when they went on sale. My brother Stefan and I were in grade school, but really wanted to go. We figured it was a once-in-a-lifetime event, as the Stones probably wouldn't be around that much longer, and seeing them now would be a big deal years from now. However, my mom thought we were a little too young to go, so she offered to tag along. My mom had been to a Beatles concert in '63, so we knew we were in good hands. So we had to camp out for tickets because that's how it was done back then for really big-name musical acts. A tumultuous, sleepless night on hard cement followed, but we all felt like released hostage survivors when it was all said and done. It was pretty festive, but wouldn't want to do it again. Disappointing, there were so many like-minded ticket scalpers outside Sun Devil Stadium on the big day. I remember one guy had a stack of about 100 tickets and was looking pretty desperate to unload. At that point, sleeping outside all night began to look like a complete waste of time. Alexander Pietrek, attendee. A man offered my mother cocaine, and she politely declined. The tickets were $17.25, a scandalous price at that time. Stephen Youngs, attendee. We got a great place in the stadium, but when the concert started, everyone stood up and pushed forward. I had to hang on to the twins by their coats so we wouldn't get separated, and had to work our way further back so that they could see. It was an amazing experience they and I have never forgotten. Lee Wright, mother and attendee. The following year, we somehow got passes to see the Hal Ashby documentary at Harkins Camelview 5. Since I knew exactly where we had been standing and that my mom had very blonde Marilyn Monroe hair, it was actually fairly easy to spot us a number of times on the big screen. Alexander Pietrek. I camped out all night with friends at Gamage to buy tickets. I was 15 years old at that show. Nosebleed seats. Had a buddy sell his ticket on the way to the show for more than he paid for it to a church guy trying to convert him. He went to their church for a couple of hours, then walked back to the stadium. Bought a better ticket for a lower price from a scalper. Then told me that God wanted him to have a better seat. Larry Mack, future radio personality and attendee. If you start me up, I'll never stop. Booing. I remember being frustrated that the opening acts were not the big name bands we had hoped for, namely The Clash. George Thorogood and Joe Eli were what we got. Alexander Pietrek, attendee. Bill Graham was the tour promoter for the Stones then. I had just started doing arena shows the year before, but had been promoting shows since 1977. Bill and I were friendly, so I went to him and said, "Are you going to do show announcements today?" He said, "Of course." So I said, "Would you mind giving a little pop for my Devo show at Veterans Memorial Coliseum coming up?" He said, "Sure, no problem." He was excited that he had something local to talk about. He went up there and said Devo and got the biggest boo I ever heard for a show announcement. Maybe they hated that Devo version of Satisfaction, because they did destroy that one pretty good. Bill was amazed. He said, "Where I come from, Devo is a pretty big band." And I said, "Not in front of these cowboys." Danny Zalisco, concert promoter and attendee. Run Like the Wind at double speed. Jagger and Richards were not getting along at this point, so you don't see any of the iconic Glimmer Twins sharing the mic. It's as if the elaborate stage ramps were designed to keep the duo as far away from each other as possible. I had obstructed view tickets. Last minute, promoters slash venue moved the stage back, and my obstructed view seats became very close to front row. I was a naive young man, not well-versed in rock and roll. From the second Keith came out, I was blown away, mesmerized the entire concert. Lawrence Zubia, future singer of the Pistoleros and attendee. Mick must have run 5 miles or more throughout the show. Ronnie and Keith were their usual selves, acting like they were having the time of their lives, which was awesome to see. Mike G. Murphy, future singer and attendee. I'll take you places that you never, never see. The lines for the girls' bathroom are so long that some of us brave rebel girls used the men's bathrooms. That was unheard of then. I am pretty sure, attending ASU football games, I tried that and was quickly escorted out for such behavior. Lynn Norgard, attendee. You make a grown man cry. Before setting off $100,000 in fireworks, the show concluded with an encore of Jumpin' Jack Flash, featuring Jagger in a cherry picker tossing out flower petals, because that's what one does in any crossfire hurricane. I looked up, and he was about 10 feet from me. I thought, wow, he sure looks old. Of course, I was 16 at the time, and anyone over 40 was ancient to me. Lisa Kelly, attendee. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock.